a couple mean field approximations to 5-4 theory for a scalar and a two-component field theory on your assignment. I'll talk about that in a little bit today. And then we're going to move on, maybe look at a bit more topics in gauge theory and stuff like that. So to wrap up mean field theory, I just want to do a quick derivation of some thermodynamic properties near the phase transition in 5-4 theory, or in mean field theory. So that's without any fluctuations. So like last time, consider the Ising ferromagnet, just to make the discussion concrete. Oops. Right, and imagine that the field phi is the magnetization. Defined last time. So as we've been looking at then, the Lagrangian density, or the free energy density, can be written with a m squared and an m4 term. And now my Hamiltonian has a broken time reversal symmetry. So I can add the term proportional to M. Right, that's the lowest order power of that field, consistent with this explicitly broken symmetry in the Hamiltonian. These even powers, right, are consistent with the symmetry of the interaction term. So we can calculate thermodynamic properties under this interpretation that, you know, my field is this magnetization. And near the transition, these thermodynamic properties take certain universal forms, if you will. Okay, so let's look at these. So first off, let's do the magnetization. And let's actually look at thermodynamics near the critical temperature. T approaches TC, which defines the change in sign, remember, of the mass term in your Lagrangian. Okay, so if you've done Landau theory before, you've probably seen these mean field expressions. So, you know, to beat a dead horse, the magnetization at any point in this, at any temperature for this free energy can be determined by minimizing it, right? So minimizing your Landau functional. This is what you're doing on your assignment before you consider fluctuations. I've given you this answer several times. The assignment should be looking pretty easy now. Right, so let me call this average, you know, the minimum our average value of this field is just m bar, and I have an h there. Right, so as you figured out by now, right, the value of m bar, the minimum of the free energy density, is just determined by solving that equation for m. So let me set h equals to 0 first off. And let me calculate m in this case, which Again, as we've discussed many times, it's two different values. So it's 0 for r greater than 0. And then it's some value, I don't know. It's going to be minus r over what, u, I guess, or r less than 0. And, okay, so the only moderately exciting thing about that is essentially the square root. And why is that exciting? Because that's a specific example of a general form for the, I guess, behavior of the order parameter as you cross that critical point. So another way of writing it . So if you wrote this magnetization more generally as, I don't know, so minus r, right, so let me just call it absolute value of t minus tc to some exponent beta, which I've just defined here, then this would give you a beta of 1/2. Seems trivial, but in the more general case, beta could be something different than 1/2 at a critical point. And this value is called, you know, a critical exponent. So this is your first possibly critical exponent. And this value is the mean field theory value of that specific exponent. Okay, so that seems almost too trivial. I'm going to talk about the significance of these exponents. They're essentially universal numbers at the transition. So, very generally, critical exponents are numbers that are universal, which means they only depend on a very small set of features, if you will, in your theory. So they depend on the dimension of the system, the dimension of the Hamiltonian generally.
There's no
sum. It's like desperate. Distress call is being communicated. So, right, sound is coming. Yeah. So, all right. Right, r is proportional to t minus tc. It's it goes through 0 at tc.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that's the difference between.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
That's weird. Thank you.
Is that just someone's webcam?
Yeah, I'm the only one left here.
Oh, can you hear us?
Can you hear me, Mac?
Yep, loud and clear.
All right, cool. The sound was recording. I guess it just wasn't broadcasting. Sorry about that. Right, so is you know, if r is greater than zero, you have a single minima, see,
right,
at m equals zero, and then turns into something like that for r less than zero.
Okay.
So that defines the temperature. You know, if you expand, you expand R and all the parameters in terms of T minus TC, T minus TC squared, right? So the phase transition in this case is a phase transition in the temperature. And the way that physical observables or thermodynamic quantities basically behave near the transition is described by universal numbers, which are called exponents. There's many universal numbers, but universal numbers mean, in some broad sense, is the details of the system don't matter. So we've always been, like, for example, we've always considered this Hamiltonian to live on a hypercubic lattice. So say a square lattice. So for example, if I had a two-dimensional square lattice, my TC for the Ising model might be some number, 2.26927, something like that. That's not a universal number. If I change to a triangular lattice, say, but it had the same Hamiltonian, maybe triangular is a bad example. Oh, triangular ferromagnet. So if I had the same ferromagnetic Hamiltonian, then TC's, I think, three point something, I forget. So the transition temperature depends on, for example, the lattice structure. But that beta, the exponent that describes how the magnetization behaves at the transition, would be the same for both of these. The beta would be 1/2 at the mean field level. And so that's why we call these numbers universal. They only depend on the dimension of the system, the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, and typically the broken symmetry ground state, you know, that you're falling into here. So that's your simplest example of a universal number calculated at the mean field level, is this beta equals 1/2. Okay. So that's magnetization. We could also calculate the susceptibility, since we're talking about a magnetic system. So this is defined as the magnetic response. Which means you have to, like, probe the system. So you push it with a magnetic field, and you see how the magnetization, how M responds to that magnetic field. So, I would define that as the derivative of the magnetization with respect to that field, taking the limit when that field goes to zero. So it's the susceptibility of say, the magnetization to influence, you know, under that application of a field. So we can calculate it from sort of our mean field free energy density. So we have a nice way of solving for magnetization here, although it gives us a form that we could write H in terms of M easier than it gives us a form that M in terms of H. So let's live a little and define the inverse susceptibility as the upside down derivative see what happens. So let me take my mean field expression and solve it for H. And then take the derivative. And then that's my inverse susceptibility. So 1 over that thing should be my susceptibility. Okay, so susceptibility is something easily measured in experiments. It's basically a bulk measurement. Oftentimes it's done, you can do it with AC frequencies, or you can do it in the DC limit. So it's essentially applying a magnetic field and then measuring the magnetization. So it's one of the most common bulk measurements in solid state or condensed matter systems. Okay, so we can use this expression to look at the susceptibility as we traverse that phase transition, you know, between those two free energy minima. So there's two cases. Again, for T less than TC, T greater than TC. So let me do the first one. Above the transition, the magnetization is 0. The expectation value, if you will, of the magnetization is 0. So it means my susceptibility is just 1 over this parameter R. So, and like we said, this is something like T minus TC. Okay, so the susceptibility is diverging basically as my distance from the critical point. If T is greater than TC, no, that's what I just did. T is less than TC, right? So my magnetization, or my m bar squared, is what I really need, is minus R over U, right? So the susceptibility expectation value, minus R over U. Okay, so this gives me something like, say, TC minus T. Okay, so I can essentially define the critical exponent. Another critical exponent. As chi, going as T minus TC to the minus, call it gamma. And at the mean field level, it's quite simply gamma is equal to 1. Okay, so again, it's something kind of trivial, but we're relating to something that's much more general. So much more general form for these, say, divergences. That's magnetization, susceptibility. Okay, another important experimental quantity is the specific heat. This is something like Yan Kishu would measure in his lab at ultra-low temperatures. They have a really nice setup to do specific heat measurements. Again, it's a bulk measurement. You put your solid state, whatever, your magnet or your crystal or whatever, in a dilution refrigerator with or without a magnetic field. The specific heat is defined as second derivative of the free energy. with his prefactor of temperature. So I have to write F in terms of T, and then take the second derivative. Okay, so again, I have two cases, above the transition and below the transition. Above the transition, M bar is 0, so my free energy would be 0. So below the transition, it's where things are a bit more interesting. Okay, so I have minus r squared over 4. That's a u. I don't know what I did there. Minus r squared over u. Yeah, so this is something like minus r over 4u squared. Yeah, r squared over 4u. Okay, so that can be related to t. So I can take this derivative because I have this term here. So then, let's see. So the first derivative, 2 over 4u, t minus tc. Second derivative, 2 over 4u. Okay, so your specific heat is just T minus T times this thing. Okay, so the minus sign works out. This is T less than TC. So if I plotted the specific heat, so CV versus temperature, I get something that's linear up to TC, where it then drops to 0. Obviously not all that physical, so there's a discontinuity. So if we write if we write the specific heat generally near the transition in this type of form, so I'd say T minus TC to the minus alpha, in this place, in this case, you could say add some constant. Then that critical exponent is just 0 at mean field level. Yeah, so mean field exponents don't have dimensions associated with them.
Okay, that, why is that?
It's just too simple of a theory.
But usually, mean field theory is the same as tree level if you look in terms of Bobatti integral.
Yeah, so it translates into something like mean field exponents are like true for 4 dimensions and higher, or something like that. So
I think it's lower than 4 dimensions, but where you have hyperscaling.
40 and higher for mean field exponents, yeah. If you're lower than 40, they change. Yeah. So we don't really discuss that much, but yeah, so like when I'm exactly. When I'm talking about universality, I'm saying the dimension matters. But you don't see dimension in any of these equations. Everything's so simple here that basically the dimension doesn't even enter into this. So alpha, again, it looks dumb, but alpha is zero at this mean field level. I can do one more. Let's see how specific heat. I can do one more exponent. That has to do with the magnetization along the critical isotherm. So when you're sitting at TC, right, but you're varying the field. So let's put the field back in for that one. So we need T equals TC. But a finite field. So again, we want to solve essentially the, we want to look for the minimum of the free energy functional. So we're solving. But for R equals zero, because R is our distance from the critical point in the temperature parameter. Okay, so this one's easy. So then H over U doesn't matter to the 1/3. So if I define the critical exponent delta, which is like H to the 1/delta, then this gives delta equals 3 So I just derived really quickly 3 critical exponents and in the mean field level. So I can compare these critical exponents from mean field theory, which again is a saddle point approximation of your 5-4 theory, to experiment, or better, exact calculation using numerical methods. I mean, but just to pretend that we care about experiment, because I'm being recorded. So alpha, which is the critical, this critical exponent for the specific heat. We never even had one because of this, the way this CV expression goes. But it's actually very small experimentally for the 3D case. So you can imagine calculating these in different dimensional systems. But if we look at a 3D gas or 3D magnet, we see that we're actually fairly close. Beta is 1/2. From our calculation, it can be compared to something that's a little bit less experimentally. The susceptibility divergence, again, is close. And delta is some big value, which again is something fairly close in 3D. So even though fairly close, I mean, I'm just writing these to give you an idea that these exponents are real, they can be measured experimentally, and the exact values are actually known because we've neglected a whole bunch of obviously a whole bunch of things when we do this mean field theory. It's so simple, right? But I think the important point I want to get across is that these exponents, so you know, I did a mean field calculation which didn't have any sort of dimension in it, but there is a dimensionality dependence in the actual exponents. Because I threw away too much when I did the saddle point approximation. I had a two-dimensional system, it would be a set of different numbers, okay? But the thing that, these are universal exponents. So if I had a more sophisticated calculation and I basically put in the full path integral, say, I would get some sort of numbers that are sort of invariant in a wide variety of systems. So if I looked at I did a three-dimensional, like a three-dimensional Euclidean path integral calculation. So the actual exact thing. So I could do the Ising model in three dimensions using Monte Carlo, for example, and calculate all these critical exponents to as many decimal places as I care to, produce waste heat on the CPU clusters. So once you have those exact numbers, because they're universal, they're the same for many different systems that have the same symmetry Hamiltonian. So liquid gas transitions are like a famous example of being in the same universality class as the Ising model. But also, be aware, as you've learned in this class, that these d-dimensional critical exponents for classical systems are the same as the critical exponents for quantum critical points in one less dimension. Okay, so if you're looking at a transverse field Ising model in one dimension, and you tune to that critical point at h over j equals 1, and you calculate exactly the critical exponents, those are the critical exponents of the two-dimensional Ising model, classical Ising model, right? So your quantum to classical correspondence comes into play when you look at these types of exponents. So even though this is a completely classical calculation, it's important to keep that in mind, I think, when you're looking at quantum systems. When you're looking at quantum critical points, the universal properties are that of a one dimension higher classical critical point. So again, to that level, quantum and classical behavior is essentially the exact same thing up to that dimension. So critical exponents. So the case where this really isn't true is cases where the Barry's phase affects the quantum critical point. And then you have to worry about interference effects with the Barry phase and everything. But I think that's far beyond the scope of this type of class. So actually these types of, I guess you would call them truly quantum universality classes, have only been discovered fairly recently and not in any experiment. So. But the same thing that screws up your path integral, the Barry phase, the complex part of the, the path integral, which we've basically integrated out in these simple Euclidean theories, they can actually come back to haunt you in more sophisticated Lagrangians. Any questions?
Yeah. But phase transition happens at zero temperature, so you're free to define exponents. Mm-hmm. How do you do it? Is there some tuning parameter that gives you
a sort of
transition?
Yeah, so it's like if you have a d-dimensional system at zero temperature, right? So you're varying some like transverse field H, that turns into something that gives you couplings in like a higher dimension. And then you can effectively just map that to, it's an R could be like H minus HC or something like that, right? So it's just the dimensionality matters. The interpretation of temperature doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be T, it can be the transverse field, say. Yeah.
Maybe this is too too general of a question, but can you like give an intuition for why it's the case that you get this like D and D plus one correspondence with the classical and quantum?
Yeah.
Like, we keep seeing it, and it happens like every class, but I don't understand why.
I mean, isn't that the question we're trying to address in the whole class? I mean, I don't know. I don't have an answer. It's a philosophical question.
Yeah.
It's like the why, you know, it's like the interference of all path, of all Feynman paths. You're integrating over all Feynman paths. That's the extra dimension. So I think it's just another fundamental representation of quantum mechanics, the extra dimension. But you're right, it's like really the moral of the class, right? It's the lesson is that a lot of the stuff that you think of as being quantum mechanical is just a classical phenomenon in one higher dimension. I don't know. Someone else, is there a better intuition?
What has brought all theoretical physics into a single thing, right? I mean, holography is based on this stuff, right?
Holography is like, yeah, so... What we don't talk about in this class is that these critical theories have some relationship, like so they have some scale invariance in them, and that scale invariance is also a conformal invariance, so they call these CFTs, conformal field theory. Do you take conformal field theory in Psi? Do people take
Not
CFTs?
In my year.
Yeah, so I think they have it now, because it's so important to understand this CFTs, right, the conformal invariance. And then this can also be interpreted as sort of a gravity theory in one higher dimension. So instead of D plus one, it's a D plus two anti de Sitter metric. So you can reformulate a lot of, I mean, maybe this is another deep philosophical thing, but you could reformulate essentially all of these field theories in terms of geometrical quantities in like two dimensional higher anti de Sitter space. Right? Makes sense, right?
Even in condensed matter, you see the same thing, right? If you have the bulk passing theory, but in the boundary of another theory, right?
Yeah, I mean.
Like you can make that bulk boundary correspondent somehow in a similar way.
Yeah, I don't know what that means in terms of generality of theories. Like, so condensed matter and field theory became unified in like the 70s, essentially. Like, this type of discussion of 5-4 theories would have came from high energy. And I think people in condensed matter realized that you can reformulate like all these Landau theories and stuff, even in the quantum mechanical cases, these one-dimensional higher theories. And it was like in the 70s, right? And the renormalization group, like, you know, all the Nobel Prizes and stuff for the RG came after, I think, all this unification of the fields into this type of 5-4 theory. But yeah, I think now, philosophically, people are looking more at this, like, this bulk boundary correspondence, and the ADS CFT is part of that. You know, I think the idea that these, you know, I don't think there's anything really, I mean, maybe it's deep in a sense, but I mean, it's just that one description of physical phenomena can have many different sort of theoretical ways of approaching it, right? So all this operator quantum mechanics that you're used to seeing, you know, is essentially exactly equivalent to all of this D plus one dimensional path integral. Does it mean that the operator and the path have some, I mean, they just are the same object. And I think in the ADS CFT, it's the same thing. All of this field theory that we're looking at just has some mathematical description in one higher like dimension if you're in negatively curved anti de Sitter space. Hopefully the holography people aren't listening to this, Bentley. No, I think it is deep, it's cool stuff, but I don't know.
One last question regarding that. So the first thing that you showed us in the lectures was that you map the transverse field isomorphism into a two-dimensional classical isomorphism, you get anisotropy, right?
So yeah.
The price you have to pay.
Right.
So you're saying that those critical exponents are independent of that anisotropy as well?
Yeah, so that's harder to answer. So the Hamiltonian is anisotropic, but you assume that, you know, in an RG sense, there's like an irrelevance in that anisotropy, and you flow to the... So you're just forgetting about that. So if you look back at your notes, I said, if the anisotropy doesn't affect the physics, then you can consider this thing as an isotropic one-dimensional higher model. So that justification really has to come from 705, from the RG. Yeah. See? God, you should have took it first. Just take 705 first. So we never offer it. No, just kidding. No, 705 is the coolest class you'll ever take. Like, the RG is the coolest thing you'll ever see. Because it, like, it explains everything that I'm talking about. But no, it really is. It's really neat. It's like, you integrate out all these, like, lattice length scale degrees of freedom. And then you essentially see, you know, you see exactly why these Euclidean theories describe critical points. So the only thing about sort of the RGE is it's only a theory of phase transitions. You know, so we're looking at symmetry breaking. We're looking at, like, the idea that there's this path integral quite generally. But the RGE is really only applicable to second order or continuous critical points. So, but, you know, it's very deep. It's you know, it gives you scale invariance, it gives you conformal invariance, and then it opens the door to all these CFTs. You can basically have, like, several classes, like lecture series, just on, like, the phase transition and then, like, the 2 and 3D Ising models. It's fascinating. So, just a word about your assignment. What are you on for? Question 3. So in question 3, you have two field components. So let's just consider that case briefly. So I'll give it two scalar components, phi 1 and phi 2. So I write the Lagrangian, I think, is essentially the same phi 4 theory, just with a vector over the fields, right? So let's look at that Lagrangian a bit more. So how would I do it? So if you didn't know anything else, you would just assume some symmetry. So let's assume fields. let's assume invariance under taking a minus sign in front of the fields. Okay, so it's just like there's no symmetry breaking magnetic field. And just write all the lowest order contributions to the coupling. So I would just have a 5-4 theory where I have labels 1. For my field number 1 plus labels 2. For my other field, and some other term, which is lowest order in the coupling, say. So lowest order coupling term that obeys this symmetry would be something like 2. I just wrote a Lagrangian for two scalar fields. Oh, and I did it with minus signs, so that means it's you know, this is the real time x prime t prime x t propagator with the Minkowski metric. Okay, so that theory, it doesn't have a lot of symmetry. Oh, I should have labeled 1 and 2 here. It doesn't have a lot of symmetry. Every parameter, you know, is different, and you'll have all sorts of different, you know, symmetry breaking and so on, depending on all the values of R1, so I call them masses, M1, M2. I want to discuss these masses more, so and U's and so on. So I don't think it's actually all that interesting. But you can make it more interesting by imposing some more symmetries. And You know, so to go from phi one and phi two having no real, like just a completely arbitrary relationship to something more interesting, we can just impose some constraints. So so what constraints do I want? I want to make the Hamiltonian invariant under interchange of those two fields. That's like the most important kind of like symmetry that I could build into this thing. Okay, that imposes constraints on M and U. I think the easiest way to think of these field components is somehow, I mean, you can imagine having two spin, you know, an X and Y direction for your local magnetization or your spin or something like that, right? So it makes sense that that type of symmetry would be in the Lagrangian. So the other one, which is less obvious just from constructing this, but we'll see what symmetry it leads to, is let me just make that rho constrained to be equal to the U value. Okay. So with those constraints, I can write my Lagrangian. So let me do it like this. Minus U. What are my one halves in front, right? Okay, so I have a gradient term, phi squared term, phi fourth term, and the lowest order coupling term, which this bottom line is just phi one squared plus phi two squared squared. This should actually be the one that's on your assignment, right? The Lagrangian that you're writing, where you're just replacing the scalar field with the two-component field will look something like this. This thing has an invariance under rotation. So if I'm imagining these two components in my field, so remember like when I just said phi, I said interpret this as an on-site magnetization of the Ising model or something like that. It's a scalar quantity. Phi was just a scalar quantity. It's just the magnitude of that, you know, say spin, or the average magnitude of that spin on that site. So it could either be negative, it could be positive. if there's fluctuations, it might, the mean value might be something different. So in this case, you have two components. You can imagine this as a magnetic spin that just lies in the XY plane. It has an X and Y component. So there's an amplitude, again, for that magnetization. It could be zero, but it could be non-zero. And if it's non-zero, it could be lying in any one of these sort of directions, X or Y. And if so, then the Lagrangian should be invariant under rotation in two-dimensional space. And that's what this thing is. So what that means is if I take my fields and I apply that rotation operator to them, then my Lagrangian should be invariant under that rotation. So for every spatial position of this field, I think it's a minus. If I perform that rotation where theta is just some arbitrary angle, then the Lagrangian's invariant. So this is a continuous symmetry, right? It's not just symmetric under time reversal symmetry or phi go to minus phi. It's the Lagrangian's invariant under essentially O2 rotations, right? So there's important differences when your system has continuous symmetry to when it just has discrete symmetries. This is what they call the it's like the ON model, the O2 model specifically, where N's the number of components on that vector, if you just write that Lagrangian like you're doing the assignment. So this is so this Lagrangian has a relationship to another Lagrangian that you'll encounter sometimes. When those fields are complex. Okay, so let's look at that relationship. So this O2 Lagrangian is the same as am I using L's or curly L's? Oh, I'm using both. It's too late now. So I think that you want the one on your assignment. You just have a vector. I forget if I have plus or minuses on your assignment for the potential term. Okay, that's another way to write that Lagrangian. Okay, so you have two-component classical fields. But in this special case, so just for this case of n equals 2, I can relate this to a Lagrangian of a complex field. just another way of looking at the same problem, essentially. So if I define, let me define my phi not as a scalar phi, but now as a complex phi. And it'll be phi 1 plus phi 2 over root 2, I think. Yeah, it's not complex without an I. Thanks. Yeah, you need an I. So let me define it as a complex field. I'll write it again as an amplitude and a phase later on. That phase, I basically want to talk about how this relates to a phase. So I have a complex field. And if I write a Lagrangian for a complex scalar, and you can imagine just generalizing. So I'll write this as an adjoint. It's just a conjugate in this case. So for example, if you're looking at your bosonic coherent state or something like that, you have complex fields in that case, right? So you can imagine this being a Lagrangian for bosons. If it's fermions, these would be Grossmann fields, and this thing would be like the conjugate of the Grossmann field. Let's not even talk about that. Okay, so here I have a Lagrangian for a complex field. And let me just substitute in my choice for real and complex components of this field and see what happens. So, okay, so just substitute this in. Okay, let me not write the, let me just take the complex conjugate. Okay, so that's the first term. The gradient term, now I need the phi star phi. What is it? It's minus. And the U there's 2/1 over root 2s. So. Plus I phi 2 squared. Okay, so if you multiply this all out, it's just constructed such that you'll always get basically terms that are, di phi 1 squared plus di phi 2 squared, and the cross terms cancel. Right? So. That should be those two squared. Okay, so it's the same as that one right there, is that Lagrangian. So the two component, so one interpretation of the phi 4 theory with two components, a two component field, is that it's essentially the theory of one complex, scalar with this Lagrangian. Okay, so that gives you a relationship between something like the XY ferromagnet and say a bosonic path integral, which I think you should expect based on the symmetry anyway. Oh yeah, so speaking of the symmetry, so that field, so that Lagrangian is invariant under multiplication of the field by a phase, as it should be. Called U1 transformation, which means if I take the field and multiply it by an arbitrary phase, or if I take the conjugate, which is the complex conjugate in this case, and perform that operation, then the Lagrangian is invariant. So it's like this O2 rotation of the XY magnet, if you will, is the same locally isomorphic to the U1 transformation for the complex field. Okay, so you're basically invariant under that arbitrary phase, which it should be. It's a global symmetry, but it's like a global gauge symmetry. I'll say the freedom of a quantum mechanical system under, or the invariance of the quantum mechanical system under transformation by a phase. Okay, so we see that O2 symmetry and U1 phase, I guess symmetries are locally isomorphic. It just has to do with the group properties of O2 and U1. It's also nice to have an interpretation of a classical two-component field as a quantum mechanical field theory. So let me take this theory and parameterize the field. So again, I have position-dependent fields. So my complex field up there, phi, is just phi of x. So phi of x. So let me call it like an amplitude and a phase. Okay, so instead of writing it as phi 1 and phi 2, I'm going to write it as rho and theta. And let's just see what the Lagrangian looks like under that parameterization. So my d phi term in the Lagrangian, So I need to take a derivative, so chain rule. So I do rho first and I rho times. the derivative of theta, right? E to the I theta. Right, so both rho and theta have, you know, have dependence on the D plus one, you know, coordinate system, coordinates. So once you figure that out, you just plug that into the full Lagrangian. So the first term is a conjugate, so I got to put a minus sign there. And on the phase, second term, no minus sign. Then I need the m squared and the u terms. Minus u, right? Minus. Okay, so now we'll play the same game. You have to, the phases all cancel. But what doesn't cancel is the d theta term. Okay, so you don't totally eliminate, I guess, the phase or the angle from the Lagrangian. Okay, so if I work that out, if I cancel all the terms, that's the resulting Lagrangian. So it's very similar to the 5-4 theory. So especially, this last piece is exactly the same as the scalar 5-4 theory. And that rho is just some scalar, right, that's parameterizing the amplitude of the field, if you will. So if I did a mean field theory, you know, if I did a saddle point approximation and I looked at the minimum of the action, and then I said, okay, these things only increase the energy, or the free energy, if you want to call it that. And I set those pieces to zero. Then I have exactly the same case of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And again, there's some interpretation of this as the parameter, which changes sign through the transition. So above the transition, it's the mass. Below a transition, it picks up, again, you pick up a vacuum expectation value. This thing's no longer interpreted as the mass. You have a spontaneous symmetry breaking. And I mean, the expectation value of, it's not even worth writing. The expectation value of rho of V is the same as in the 5-4 theory. It's root, you know, minus m squared over u or 2u or something like that. Theta, on the other hand, is completely arbitrary. Okay, so you have a vacuum expectation value here. So, in, at the mean field level, doesn't matter where, you know, it doesn't matter what angle, if you will, these spins point at, if you want to think of it like that, because that's only contributing to this fluctuation term. So sort of the mean field theory of the XY magnet, if you will, is that below the transition temperature, you pick an arbitrary angle, and then you essentially point all of your spins along that theta. And there's an amplitude. So the mean field has an amplitude, a vacuum expectation value that's non-zero. Above the phase transition, the XY magnet is just disordered, right? So if you average the position of all the spins, it would just average to zero. So it's basically like at mean field level, you've chosen some whatever arbitrary angle, and you've called that theta equals zero, and then every field has a vacuum expectation value that's like the same as what you saw in the scalar case. So where the O2 case gets interesting is when you start adding fluctuations. Okay, so when you go one step beyond mean field theory, like you're doing in your assignment, you add a fluctuation term to the vacuum expectation values. Okay, so let me do that. Let me go one step beyond mean field. So small, I'd say, perturbations of the parameters, or small fluctuations around the vacuum expectation value. Let me call it chi, and 0 plus theta prime. Okay, so these are the small fluctuations. So it's like you're sitting in the bottom of that potential minima that you're drawing on your assignment 4. So you're going to see the shape of this minima. It should look like what do they call it? It's like you got to draw it in the XY plane. It should have a minima that's basically a circle. They call it like a Mexican hat potential or a wine bottle. I forget what they call it. Mexican hat sounds racist. I shouldn't say it. But it's a three, you know, you'll draw a three-dimensional surface. So now we're fluctuating around that minimum of that free energy surface, okay? So there's an amplitude fluctuation, and there's a phase fluctuation. And so just like your assignment, you throw this into your Lagrangian. So the Lagrangian becomes something like that. M squared and V plus chi fourth. Again, there's only one d theta term. It's theta plus theta prime. You know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna drop the prime. Because I'll forget it. So theta is my fluctuation, okay? Because I just started at theta equals zero. So now my Lagrangian is rewritten in terms of the vacuum expectation values plus the fluctuation. This kind of stuff is zero, right? I assume that I'm basically locked into that vacuum expectation value. I have a d theta squared term. I have a d chi. Oh, I forgot the square on something. This one here. And I have terms that are like m squared, v squared, m squared, So let me expand the m squared term. 2m squared v chi minus m squared chi squared. Okay, so that's this term. Again, this one, this is a constant, right? So this is a constant. This one's 0, this one's a constant. And when I do the u term, there's going to be all sorts of terms that are just, they don't have a chi in them, they're just constants. All right, so I'm going to throw those ones out. Nice. So here's all my terms with chi plus constants. All right, so I have some sort of weird Lagrangian that has a theta squared term, has a chi squared term. the derivatives of chi squared. I have a chi and a chi squared term, but there's no theta squared term. What's the coefficient of a square term? Right? It's the mass. So there's no mass in this case. And so this is the same type of Lagrangian that when you, on your assignment, question 2, you know, for the scalar theory, you expand out in terms of fluctuations, you get a mass term with a proper sign. So in the complex scalar, or the O2 two-component field theory, there is no mass term for the theta. There's only a mass term for the chi. So you can see this at that level without interpreting anything else. Further than that, you can essentially see that you have a massless field. So this is quite generic. Anytime you have a continuous symmetry, remember the rotations in XY space, it's like a continuous symmetry. So anytime you have that type of continuous symmetry and you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, so we've spontaneously broken a continuous symmetry when we basically choose these vacuum expectation values, I guess up here, before the fluctuations, right? Then you'll see the emergence of a massless field. Amplitude. So I have an amplitude for my field. So the amplitude mode picks up a mass. And the phase is massless. That massless mode, the fact that phi, that no phi squared term exists, that's your Goldstone mode. So if you think of this as any, so if you think of this as like excitations around that ground state of the XY ferromagnet. Right? So the amplitude mode is the fact that you want to decrease the length of each one of these spins, right? This is like the vacuum expectation value. At high temperature, then each one of these would give an expectation value of zero. So the amplitude or the magnitude of the spin would decrease. But in the fluctuation theory, that's associated with a mass. And what does mass mean with energy? What's a mass-energy relationship? It means you have a gap to excitations. So just like in the scalar case, it's like if you want to flip a spin in the Ising model, it costs you some domain energy, right? So it's the same here. It's like if you want to somehow, you know, change the magnitude of the average field, because you have a chi-squared term, there's a mass associated with that. There's an energy gap. So you need a finite amount of energy. It's just like saying if you have a massive particle, you need a finite amount of energy to, you know, excite it to some higher momentum state, right? So if you have discrete momentum states and you want to jump to some momentum state, if there's a gap associated with that, you got to overcome that gap, right? But in the Goldstone mode, or in the phase, say, there's no gap to exciting what turns out to be long wavelength excitations between the spins. So the Goldstone mode looks like the idea that you have spins, but you can slightly change the angle between them at a very long wavelength. Okay. And there's no discrete energy penalty to just sort of offsetting neighboring spins by an infinitesimal amount. So that's the interpretation of this massless mode. So you need this continuous symmetry to have it. If you just have discrete symmetry like in the Ising model, then you basically don't have that type of long wavelength excitation possible. There's lots of Goldstone modes in nature. Like phonons are a Goldstone mode, essentially. Anything that's sort of massless. So because it's massless, because you don't have to put in any energy to overcome a gap, you know, to that excitation, you might ask whether or not that thing destroys the phase. And just like in the Pyrrhal's argument, you say, you know, in perturbation theory, we basically look at some sort of excited state. So in the series expansion, there's these minority droplets, and you ask when those things proliferate and destroy the phase. Well, when does this like weird massless changing, you know, changing of local angles by infinitesimal amounts? When does this thing actually destroy the vacuum expectation value? When does it destroy the idea that we can even call this thing a phase? So that's easy to derive in 5 minutes or less. Gapless or massless, I'll call it massless. The stability of the, you know, vacuum expectation value of the symmetry broken phase. Let me do it in the language of your assignment. So let me consider phi 1 has a vacuum expectation value plus a fluctuation, and phi 2 is just phi 2. prime because the vacuum expectation value, that's what you should find on your assignment. And it, then you should also find, so I kind of did it for the complex boson, but if you do it for the two real components, you should also find that this is massless. I guess I should have made you do this part on the assignment. So consider the fluctuations. So the mean square fluctuations of this field. And we'll look at whether or not these things diverge. So remember, I have a functional integral. I basically have an expectation value of these fields. And let me write this as the limit when I'm looking at the two-point correlation function between those fields. So I just have an expectation value. And now I can imagine looking at the two-point correlation function, which we kind of know. So that's a limit of, say, the Gaussian G naught. And we know what this is in dimension D in momentum space. So this is where all this sort of derivation of these two-point correlation functions, these green functions, actually can come in and give us some useful physics insight.
What is M?
Pardon?
What is M?
That's the mass.
Of which?
Of the mode.
But it's prime is massless.
All right. So in this integral, your mass is zero because of that, because there's no, it doesn't matter what the symbol in front of, you know, it could be some combination of different constants. But when I calculate the two-point correlation function of that field, and I write it like this, that thing is the mass. That's the coefficient of the theta squared term. So the stability of the phase can just be evaluated by, you know, whether or not that integral diverges. So let me just write the, I'll put in, you know, it's in momentum space. So I have some long wavelength and I have some short wavelength behavior. So let me just call this the IR and the UV limits. Then I have this d-dimensional integral. And it's just, let's just say it's 1 over p squared. That's the important part. Right, so this thing, there's an angular piece, right? So if you do it in polar coordinates, I'll just call that the angular piece. I have the UV and the IR, IR and the UV. So what's left over from this d to the dp, the integration variable is just d minus 1. So just all these angular constants out front, 2 pi to the d, p to the d minus 3. So all you have to see from this integral is that when your dimension is greater than 2, that integral converges, and otherwise it diverges, right? You'll have like a, say a 1 over p, then you have to evaluate at p equals 0. So that infrared part gives you a divergence. The UV part, this is just like a lattice length scale. It's the smallest momenta that you would ever imagine, right? So you don't really worry about that. But the divergence comes from the fact that that thing is like 1 over x or something at, or log x at x equals 0. Converges. D is less than or equal to 2. So the interpretation is that the fluctuations, right, the mean square fluctuations, if you want to call it that, diverges for D is less than or equal to 2. So that tells you whether or not the phase is stable against inclusion of Goldstone modes. That phase that I just erased, the physical state of matter, the divergence. So I'll say the theta fluctuations or the transverse fluctuations, whatever you want to call them. This kills a long-range order. This is the Merman-Wagner theorem. No long-range order in systems with a broken spontaneously broken continuous symmetry. In D, less than or equal to 2. That's it. So Goldstone modes kill the long range order. You can write the Lagrangian.
You know. D less than 2?
If it's D equals to 2, then it's 1 over P, so it's a log.
Right, so in D so, less than or equal to 2, the integral diverges and the long range order is killed.
So there's no long range order if in dimensions D less than or equal to 2. Yeah. That's at, you know, physically that's at finite temperature too. So really the fluctuations, right, the Goldstone fluctuations have to come from something. So either finite temperature or they can be quantum, right? But if you're thinking of just this, these classical, this D plus one dimensional classical path integrals. So basically the temperature, any finite temperature kills your long range order at D1 and D2. So you have to have a three dimensional, you know, if you have an XY model, you have to have a three-dimensional XY model to have any long-range order in the system at any finite temperature, or the fluctuations kill them. So it's pretty, you know, it's you have all the sort of tools to put this type of thing in. It's actually very non-trivial, this Merman-Wagner theorem. But once you have the Lagrangian, the mean field theory plus fluctuations, you know, I just did a really quick and dirty look at the mean square of the fluctuations. And you see that you can't have that order. That integral just is unphysical. So it's Goldstone modes that kill your order in these dimensions.
So how does that, like, in two dimensions there, we wrote the field and then the state.
Yep.
Like, that variable doesn't actually even make sense to be there, given that.
So
define theta and less than 2.
No, so the dimension, so it's like a one-dimensional lattice with say XY spins or you know three component spins or any continuous symmetry, you can have 04 or 5, 06, or you have a two-dimensional lattice.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
So that the D is the
Okay.
I was calling it N.
Yeah,
big
yeah.
N. So that's the component of the spin. But D is the dimension of the lattice.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you see this numerically? Like if you say you have the XY model or whatever in 1D with O2 spins, is this possible to see numerically? Like if you plot the correlation function, say.
It's hard. You have to work hard because on finite systems, finite size systems, you actually get basically quasi you basically look at it and you get quasi long range order. So you have to look really carefully at the correlation functions as a function of system size and go to very large sizes. So if you just do a simulation of the 2D XY model and look below the costless stylus transition, so if you look below the costless stylus transition, it looks ordered. It looks like it's chosen a spontaneous direction, it's ordered, but it's basically algebraic decay, or in that whole phase. And so it's actually a little bit subtle to see numerically. But if you do very careful finite size scaling and look at the correlation functions, then you'll see that you don't have long range order. So it's actually easier to see, much easier to see, I think, in this analytical treatment. All right, I'm adding up all the time, extra time that I'm keeping you, and we're going to cancel classes at the end of the semester based on how much time I've kept you here. Well, as soon as I run out of lecture notes.